This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, Subversity with Dan Zhang. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Today, we're going to be talking about the elections tomorrow, and we'll be interviewing some people that are in the area, and not actually in the area, but in America, and talking about their take. They will be talking about their take, or we'll be airing some commentary also about elections. But first, let's listen to a little bit of hip-hop about elections. We'll actually have some divergent views here about why vote or why not vote, why don't vote, and also the differences between Democrats and Republicans, if there's any. So I know that people are expecting a landslide by the Democrats, but is it really going to happen? But first off, we're going to talk about the religious right with Chip Burley, who's a senior analyst with the Political Research Associates, and their website is at www.publiceye.net, .org, publiceye.org. And they've just come up, the PRA has just come out with a new report about the religious right and its impact on elections and how they strategize and organize. And so we talked with him actually on Friday, and so we're going to air that mini interview right now.
We tried to explain the fact that the Christian right actually does not represent all evangelical voters, as evangelical voters for the midterm elections, with some mixed successes, and that really you need to see evangelical voters as a potential swing vote, and that as we approach the election, that's becoming increasingly clear that it's a swing vote around the issue of the war. But folks, no matter how the Christian right does in turning out its voters in the midterm elections, people will either overrepresent it as all evangelicals, or if they don't do very well this time, people will once again announce that the Christian right is dead, and they do that periodically. The pundits like to say, oh, the Christian right, they fell apart this time, so they're gone. And the fact is that there always has been a Christian right in the United States, and sometimes their electoral fortunes rise and sometimes they fall. But as a social movement, it's very durable. So we're trying to explain how exactly the voting demographics work. The fact that there will be a real outreach campaign this year built around really nasty homophobic rhetoric akin to gay marriage initiatives. But that no matter how the election results come back on Tuesday, the Christian right is still going to be around as a powerful political force.
How would the events of today, like the news yesterday that this evangelical pastor was supposed to have picked up a prostitute for 3 years and had sex with him?
Well, there have been a series of sexual scandals involving Christian right leaders and Christian right, icons lately, and that's not the first time that's happened. We've seen Christian right leaders caught literally with their pants down before. And generally, in Christian evangelical culture, that's considered very distasteful, but sinners can always repent and be brought back into the fold. So I think that while... I'm sorry?
No, I'm laughing.
Oh, well, okay. Sinners can always repent and be brought back into the fold. So that may not have as much an effect as the general dissatisfaction with the way the war in Iraq is going, because a lot of Christian evangelicals are... traditionally torn between wanting a strong defense but also being mandated by the Bible to seek peace. And so when they're very unhappy with the way a war is being led by a Republican in this case, they're not likely to vote Democratic as much as they're likely to simply not go to the polls, mm-hmm. which would be disastrous for Republicans, because in the last major elections, federal elections, whether they're midterm or presidential, the Christian right has played a very, very important role in turning out voters in certain key states.
How about the revelation that in this new book that the Bush administration people were laughing at the Christian right, making jokes, calling them bozos or whatever?
Well, again, I think that that gets a lot more play in the liberal press than it does in the conservative evangelical press, especially fundamentalists, who are kind of the most unhappy and aggressive of the evangelicals, the most doctrinaire, the most unwilling to compromise with secular society or science. Fundamentalists are especially used to being made fun of. That's basically been their lot in life since the Scopes Monkey Trial in the 20s. Which was about creationism versus evolution. And, of course, the Christian right won that case. So we're looking at a situation where the sexuality scandals and some of the other events of people making fun of evangelicals in mainstream political life, I don't think that's going to be as much of a factor in the upcoming election as the war in Iraq, but also the economy and poverty and health care and other issues. The mistake is to think that Christian evangelicals, not all of whom are part of the Christian right, when they think of values when they vote, they only think of abortion and gay rights, and that's not true. They oppose abortion and gay rights, but they also, when they think of values, they think of helping the poor, they think of having quality health care, they think of having a strong economy so that they and their family can have jobs. So it's a very complicated set of situations, and we've tried to explain in the report how that exactly works. And the fact that the major Christian right organizations have stepped forward to replace the Christian Coalition, which fell on hard times, in the role of being the political mobilization force for the Republican Party, that's really interesting to see these four organizations step forward and relaunch the political organizing for the Christian right. And that would be the Family Research Council, run by Tony Perkins, the Focus on the Family, James Dobson, the Americans United to Preserve Marriage, run by Gary Bauer, and the American Family Association of Donald Wildman. They all have these action arms now that have formed a coalition to step forward and do the political organizing, and they've chosen a really nasty homophobic campaign against gay marriage as the technique to get voters out to the polls.
How influential is traditional a values coalition?
Well, they're not as influential as they once were. They certainly are very still influential in the California area, and they're a player. But it's interesting to see that when this coalition was put together, the people who really run it, which are primarily Perkins and Dobson and Bauer, reached out to Donald Wildman of the American Family Association based in Mississippi rather than traditional values based in California. And I think that's significant, and it really means that TVC has sort of been pushed a little bit aside.
Did TVC try to work more with African-American pastors?
Well, actually, all the major Christian evangelical groups that are conservative in orientation, and especially those tied to the Christian right, have for a number of years now made very aggressive outreach to black pastors. And this started all the way back with the videotape, The Gay Agenda, the videotape that was produced after that around attacking gay rights, was really tied to arguing that gay people demanding full civil rights were insulting the black civil rights movement. And it's a very effective strategy, and it continues to bring black pastors into this coalition. We saw black pastors at the Value Voters Summit that was held in Washington, D.C. in late September. And again, in Boston at Liberty Sunday, there were a number of black pastors. You know, probably the best known name would be Wellington Boone. And they're very willing, the black pastors, to speak out aggressively against gay rights.
How would the Foley case, the Congressman Foley's case, impact on the religious right?
Well, again, sexuality issues are sin, and sin is something that you can always redeem yourself from. So I think that there's dissatisfaction and anger at the Republicans for the Foley situation. But again, the result isn't that they will necessarily turn and vote Democratic. They may choose not to vote. But again, I think the mainstream media is making much too much of the sexuality scandals and the insults from the White House and not paying enough attention to the fact that value voters among the Christian evangelical electorate Our people right now who are mostly looking at Bush's handling of the war in Iraq and the economy and health care and poverty and other issues like that.
And are they dissatisfied with what Bush is doing in Iraq?
They're very dissatisfied with what Bush is doing in Iraq, and a poll that just came out yesterday shows clearly that a number of traditionally Republican-voting evangelicals are extremely unhappy with the war in Iraq and are telling pollsters that they might decide to simply not vote. Very few are saying that they're going to vote Democratic. And remember that a lot of evangelical voters consider themselves independent and really are these swing voters. It's true that last time, like 75% of the conservative evangelicals who went to the polls voted Republican. But that isn't necessarily always the case. We've seen in previous elections when issues like the economy and other such issues that are, you know, values to evangelicals have trumped the sexuality issues, the gender issues.
How about the statistical breakdown by ethnicity of the supporters of the religious right? How many are?
When we talk about evangelical voters being mobilized to vote Republican, we're talking primarily about white Christian evangelicals. Black Christian evangelicals vote 95% for Democrats in presidential elections and have a similar kind of voting demographic in midterm elections. So really what we're looking at is the mobilization of white Christian evangelical voters. But remember, a lot of white Christian evangelical voters have family and friends and colleagues that have been sent to Iraq, and they're very dissatisfied with the way that war is being handled, and that may easily turn out to trump the sexuality and gender issues that are being used to mobilize these voters by this coalition of Christian right leaders.
How about Latinos and Asians? Any special thing about how they would vote, you think? If they are
interesting polling data now about Catholics, Latinos, Asians, and other voting blocs being pulled in different directions by some of the organizing, but it's really not clear how that's going to play out, and I rather suspect that some of the polling data that comes out of the midterm elections will provide a clearer picture, especially with the Latino vote. There was some lack of clarity about how people define themselves, whether they thought of themselves as Latino or Hispanic or a number of other terms. It wasn't clear how many of them were Catholic, and we tend to forget that a number of new Latino voters in the United States who may have come out of Catholic traditions have converted to evangelical Protestantism. So looking at a range of voting patterns has been difficult in the last few elections, and maybe by having some more data from this election, we'll be able to know more if there's a trend or if there's just blips.
Even in Orange County, the Republican registration has gone under 50% now. And among new voters, even Vietnamese are registering independent to a greater extent than they did before.
Right, that seems to be a tendency for Asian voters across the board of seeing themselves more as independent than Republican. But again, you know, you need a more a set of data points in a row to be able to draw any clear conclusions. But what's clear right now is that a number of different constituencies that have long thought to have leaned towards the Republican Party are seeing themselves as independents or actually switching to become independents, and many of them are dissatisfied with the Bush administration, both its foreign policy and its domestic policy.
So would you hazard a prediction about Tuesday's vote?
It's so volatile. What we have are these major Christian right organizations going completely ballistic around gay marriage and really sending out emails and letters and faxes warning about the destruction of the American family at the hands of the marauding and rapacious gay community with its homosexual agenda. I mean, I can't stress to you how alarmist and bigoted and really nasty this rhetoric is. That may provide a boost, last-minute boost, to Republican politicians, but it may not. Again, you can pull the gender card and the sexuality card only so often, and when issues like a war in Iraq or the economy or other domestic issues are really more on the minds of even Christian evangelical voters who are conservative, it's quite possible that they'll simply say, well, you know, I'm against abortion, I'm against gay marriage, I don't like gay civil rights, but I'm really unhappy with the war, and so either I'm not going to vote, or I may vote, you know, for only a handful of candidates in the election.
So mainly, they might just stay home, too.
Well, yeah. What I'm saying is that they may simply choose not to vote.
Well, yeah, thank you. Yeah.
That was a short interview with Chip Burleigh, who's the senior research analyst with Political Research Associates in, I think, Somerville, Massachusetts. They've just put out a new report that Chip co-wrote with Pam Chamberlain, and the title is Running Against Sodom and Osama, the Christian Right Values Voters and the Culture Wars in 2006. So there he was talking about what values the conservative and Christian right value, what values they value. And he in the report, they argue that Chip and Pam argue that it's misleading. It's often the Christian right likes to pretend that all this is not about partisan politics, but the reality is quite different. Even the ultra-conservative Washington Times reports the obvious, and that is, they quote from certain key leaders of the Christian right, like like Mr. Dobson and the Family Research Council, and how they rally the troops for the midterm elections by reminding them that Republicans helped to get two new conservative justices on the Supreme Court, and that Democrats are still blocking legislation and President Bush's judicial nominations. And this is a quote from the Washington Times. They also specifically have been targeting this midterm election, and they've been arguing that families are at risk, and so there's a number of propositions around the country on gay marriage, like against that, obviously. And they also have been arguing that that they need a Christian counterculture to overcome the depravity of secularized modern life. So all this is from this report, and that the religious right will win because God is on our side. There was also a Values Voters Summit that was organized to prepare voters for this election, and they have actually been very active in churches, obviously, and yet this is counter, you know, a counter example to what, or counter way the administration has been looking at this is, instead of warning churches about the possible loss of non-partisans of tax status, like a tax exempt status, instead of doing that with religious right groups, the IRS has now been investigating partisanship aimed specifically at progressive Christians who are on the left. The target, of course, is All Saints Church in Pasadena, which is a well-known place where progressive Christian values are expressed throughout LA area, this report says. And the investigation, which threatens to pull the church's tax-exempt status, is based in part on a sermon by the Reverend Dr. George F. Regas in 2004, titled, If Jesus Debated Senator Kerry and President Bush. So anyway, that shows the partisanship of the IRS in picking out targets to go against. So there's the report doesn't end with kind of a hopeless thing. It ends with a little section on what progressives can do, an effective progressive response to this. And basically it's arguing that demonize the religious right. Demonizing rhetoric from the left not only pushes evangelicals away from the Democratic Party, but also pushes them out of potential partnerships with around progressive issues, it says. And from a progressive standpoint, the issue is not electing Democrats, but holding all politicians accountable for advancing social and economic justice. That kind of eerily echoes what is in the on the front page of the new university today. This new university is the UCI, UC Irvine paper, arguing that a subtitle is actors, advocate, parent, and assembly men, advocate, parent, I guess, and assemblyman urge voting across partisan lines. And that was a reference to a rally earlier in the week by the Progressive Democrats Association, Progressive Democrats, I mean, of America, sorry, who were here at UC Irvine's flagpole. Ed Asner was here, Cindy Sheehan was here in by via cell phone, and Ed Asner's wife, also Cindy, was here also. And they're like active in the Progressive Democrats Association. They were here to support 48th District Assemblyman candidate, or congressional candidate, Steve Young. He's running for the 48th District, District in the House of Representatives. And funnily enough, when Steve Young spoke, he actually asked people to vote across Democratic, across partisan lines, instead of rallying the Democratic vote. The Progressive Democrats, of course, the left-wing portion of the Democratic Party, who are upset at the other Democrats who have done nothing to stop the war. And so they're a small group, and they are against the war, and yet they want people to vote for Democratic Party, even though the Democrats haven't done anything to stop Bush's unconstitutional actions. And so we're going to hear now from, you're listening to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. We're going to hear a contrarian voice that tries to argue that there's really no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans in a partisan election forum, and in their leadership as well. And so we're going to hear a little clip from Bob Avakian, who leads the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party. Let's go to that clip.
I want to move on and talk briefly about what is a concentrated focus of struggle now, one of the main concentrations of struggle now, which is driving out the Bush regime. One of the things I think we have to make very clear to people in the context of what's going on, in particular these elections that are taking place, whether we raise it as a formal slogan or not, what we have to make very clear to people is that even if the Democrats win through the 06 elections, we will not. The essence of this, whether formulated exactly in those specific terms or in some other, the essence of this is crucial to grasp and to struggle to win other people to grasp. And it goes back to the point, all the points I was making in relation to the basic understanding that the Democrats, as much as the Republicans, are a ruling class political party. And what that means in fundamental terms and in the context of what's going on in the world today. I mean, look at the reality. Go down the list. Let's just do a quick survey here. Iraq, Iran, the Patriot Act, the Pledge of Allegiance. You remember that? Where were the Democrats when the court out in California made a ruling that under God should be taken out of the Pledge of Allegiance because it violated separation of church and state? They were out with the Republicans in front of the Capitol building reciting the Pledge of Allegiance with emphasis on under God. That's where the Democrats were, so much for their principled and firm stand in defense of separation of church and state. Where are they on the Flag Amendment, so-called desecration? Dianne Feinstein just wrote an article defending the passage of this amendment. Where are they on academic freedom, critical thinking, and dissent? Where are they? Are they out in front defending and beating back the attacks on this? Or are they either silent or joining in the attacks? In the case, for example, of Ward Churchill and others, what have they done, and where has their stand been? What about abortion and birth control? What about the defense of traditional marriage and, among other things, its anti-gay stance? What about taking on or not taking on the Republic fascists around all this? Where are they on religion and the defense of science, for example, around the battle on in relation to evolution? Where were they in Katrina in relation to what's going on in the inner cities, on the immigrants? Where in any of this are they taking a stand that represents interests fundamentally different than what the Republicans are bringing forward, and in particular represents the interests of the people in all this? So the question once again comes back to, after we see what stands they take and don't take, why do the Democrats take this position and have the overall stand that these positions embody and represent? And the essential reason, and it's important for, not only for us to grasp this, but to be able to struggle substantively with people around this, the essential reason is not that they do this or somehow need to do it to get elected. Once again, this is viewing everything and accepting the terms, confines, and dynamics of bourgeois electoral politics. Electability becomes the criterion for everything. But that is not why the Democrats do what they do. It is sometimes why they say they do what they do. But it is not the actual reason why they do what they do. It goes back to, and the reasons are rooted in what I was discussing earlier, actual dynamics of the system, the whole point in relation to the pyramid of power analysis. This is why they take the stands they do and don't take the stands they don't. Once again, you can look at the great discrepancy or disconnect, to use their word, between the stance and positions of a Democratic Party as determined by its leadership and what the great majority of the rank-and-file Democratic Party adherents and those who end up voting for the Democrats actually think and what they want to see as the stance and positions of the Democrats. This is a very acute contradiction, and we should be not only pointing to it and hammering home that point of what an acute contradiction is, but going deeply into the reasons for why there is this contradiction and why it repeatedly poses itself very acutely, rooted in all the reasons that I've spoken to up to this point. And it's very important to bring home that this regime must be, it's not a matter of the of Bush at all being voted out, even assuming that would happen. But it's a matter and a question that it must be driven out through the actions of masses of people, through independent and historical political action on a truly massive scale. Because it's only if that happens that the terms of things can be changed in a way that holds the potential of something favorable for the people and in their interest to actually emerge out of this. And this is a crucial point to really grasp deeply and to struggle with people over. If you let things go on in the dynamics of the elections, whether or not the Democrats win back more seats in the Congress now and whether or not they run some candidate who wins in 2008, the dynamics and the framework of everything is going to be more and more unfavorable and more horrific. By that time, we may be at war with Iran, and think of everything that that implies. I'm not saying that that will definitely happen, but it is a definite possibility. And, one of the most chilling things is when you read that in the articles in our paper and other places where it quotes that, you know, former official of the government running down all the terrible things that would happen if we attack Iran and then saying, but those aren't as bad as not attacking Iran if that's what's needed to not allow it to have nuclear weapons. How does voting for the Democrats figure into that, let alone all the other things that I've mentioned? The point is, and we really have to drive this point home to people, the whole political calculus must be dramatically changed. And that is not going to happen through this electoral process and by staying within the confines that dominate the political scene now. The whole political calculus must be dramatically changed. The whole political terrain must be completely transformed. And that cannot and will not happen other than through independent and historical political action on a truly massive scale. The current dynamics and trajectory must be ruptured onto something radically different through this mass political action. And this is something we have to grasp deeply ourselves and struggle really effectively to win people to come to terms and grips with, because many people don't want to come to terms and grips with this. because it's frightening. And it challenges everything that they believe and want to believe, particularly more in the middle strata, but not only there, about the whole nature of this country and the whole character of how it, political decision-making goes on and all the implications if that's not the way political decision-making goes on, particularly in the context of all the heavy things that are already happening and are hanging heavily in the air. So we have to emphasize to people that we have to bring this. We, through mass political action, have to bring this to a halt. The wars, the lies, the torture, the spying and repression. That is why we have to focus and raise as the battle cry, the political battle cry, the world can't wait, drive out the Bush regime, because we have to bring this to a halt. And no one else is going to do that. And no other dynamic is going to achieve that. And we need to discuss with people in a living and a substantive way why that's so and what that means.
So that's the dilemma, as enunciated by Bob Avakian, who leads the Revolutionary Communist Party in the United States. How do you, you want to drive, people like him and other activists want Bush out, the Bush regime out, but what do you replace it with? Are the Democrats going to be doing anything better? Of course, there'll be maybe some breathing space, but are they not? Will they not invade Iran, North Korea, whatever? The war is in the air, and war talk, military talk, and so what's the difference in the ultimate sense? So let's go back and let's play a little music interlude here, and we can then come back to our program. We're going to be talking to or listening to a little bit discussion on another topic of interest that is coming up tomorrow, and we can get back to that in a second. You're listening to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. We're going to take a look at the propositions that are upcoming in California that are facing voters here in the state. One in particular, Proposition 83. The title is Sex Offenders, Sexually Violent Predators, Punishment, Residence Restrictions, and Monitoring Initiative Statute. So how's that? Very wordy. This is a high-tech kind of initiative. It's using GPS, global positioning satellites, to monitor people who have been convicted of sex crimes. There will be GPS tracking, electronically monitor through GPS tracking dangerous sex offenders for life once they finish their prison terms. So basically, California is going back to the days of repressive legislation, repressive sex laws that would send people in into psychiatric hospitals even, similar to that, for life. So basically, even if you have served your term, this law, this proposition, if enacted tomorrow, would track people for life. And it argues that it will protect children from internet predators by cracking down on people who sexually victimize children and require mandatory minimum prison sentences for dangerous child molesters and sex criminals. And it would also charge anybody who possesses child pornography, prosecutors would charge them with a felony. That's the argument. Some of the people who are arguing in support of Proposition 83 argue that all these things will happen. And it's called Jessica's Law, named after Jessica Lunsford, a 9-year-old girl who was kidnapped, assaulted, and buried alive by someone who failed to report where he lived, a sex offender. And Jessica's Law is supported by a bunch of people who are, of course, the father of Jessica, and lots of community groups and some law enforcement groups. And they argue that the supporters of this proposition argue that it means safer schools, safer parks, and safer neighborhoods. It means these people will, children, these molesters will be kept away from our children and monitored for life. And we cannot wait another day to protect our kids. So that's the people that that are arguing for this proposition, including the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. In rebuttal to the argument in favor of Proposition 83, the rebuttal argues that the argument in favor of Prop 83 ignores the sad lessons learned by other states. For example, the leading prosecutors association in Iowa, which once urged the adoption of laws similar to Prop 83, now argues that these laws be repealed because they have been proven to be ineffective, a drain on crucial law enforcement resources, and far too costly for two taxpayers. California cannot afford to repeat that mistake. The proponents claim that the law is directed at child molesters and dangerous sex offenders, but its most punitive and restrictive measures would apply far more broadly, even to those convicted of misdemeanor, nonviolent offenses. They would also apply to people who have long led law-abiding lives for years after completing their sentences. More specifically, the proposition would prohibit thousands of misdemeanor offenders from living near a school or park for the rest of their lives. For instance, and this is my interjection, if you have dated somebody under the age of consent and they find out, you could be subject to this law if convicted. Impose lifetime GPS monitoring on first-time offenders convicted of nonviolent offenses. For example, 19-year-old boy could be subjected to, and this is could be subjected to lifetime monitoring after a conviction for having sexual contact with his 17-year-old girlfriend. Impose lifetime residence restrictions and lifetime GPS monitoring on thousands of people who have lived law-abiding lives for years or even decades. There's already laws that protect children, so they argue. This does not. Don't be fooled. And so this was written by somebody called Carlene Arledge, who heads the California Attorneys for Criminal Justice. So you can read about all these arguments online at the California General Election website, which I believe is, you can Google that. We have a link, I think we have a link on it, to it from the Subversity website at kuci.org/tildeDTSANG to this proposition. So this proposition actually goes far beyond what is already on the books. And one thing it does do is that it allows more people, more sex offenders eligible for this kind of commitment, long-term commitment. Lifelong commitment, and also the costs of it are quite high. One of the summary of the legislative analyst's estimate argues that the fiscal impact of this law would be really high. The net prison, parole, and mental health program costs of several tens of millions of dollars initially would be growing to a couple of $100 million annually within 10 years. There will be also potential one-time state mental hospital and prison capital outlays costs eventually reaching several $100 million if Proposition 83 were passed. And this is the legislative analyst's analysis prepared by prepared by the legislature as a person in charge of analyzing fiscal impacts. And the net state and local costs for court and jail operations, of course, are unknown depending on how many people are subject to this law. So basically, they argue that the definition of sex offenses actually can vary. For instance, since distribution of obscene material is a misdemeanor and rape is a felony sex offense. Current law defines the penalties for conviction of sex-related crimes depending particularly primarily on the type and severity of the offense, of the specific offense. And so you could be charged with a felony or you could be charged with a misdemeanor. There are about 8,000 people convicted of felony sex offense each year in California. Of these, about 39% are sent to state prison. Most of the rest are supervised on probation in the community, 5%, sentenced to county jail, 1%, or both, which is makes up the majority, 53%. Current law actually does already require offenders convicted of specified felony or misdemeanor sex crimes to register with local law enforcement. And there's already 90,000 registered sex offenders in California. Current law bars parolees convicted of sex specified sex offenses against a child from residing within 1/4 of 1 mile, 1,320 or 2,640 feet respectively of a school already. The California criminal system already utilizes global positioning system, actually not satellite, global positioning system, GPS, monitoring devices to track the location of some offenders on parole. Currently, this monitoring is limited to about 1,000 sex offenders who have been identified as high risk to offend, to reoffend. Some county probation departments also use GPS already to monitor some sex offenders on probation. Some of the people are identified as sexually violent predators. Under current law, an SVP is defined as a person who has been convicted of a sexually violent offense against two or more victims and who has a diagnosed mental disorder that makes a person a danger to health and safety of others, in that it is likely that he or she will engage in sexually violent criminal behavior. These people are referred to the district attorney's offices to determine whether they whether one should pursue the commitment by the courts to treatment in a state hospital, mental hospital, as an SVP. In these offices, in these proceedings, SVP proceedings, the offenders are often represented by public defenders. And so you have some right to a defense. The proposal, however, is to increase as of June 2006, 456 sex offenders are being held in state hospitals with a commitment by a court as an SVP. In addition, 188 sex offenders are being currently held in state mental hospitals and 81 in county custody pending completion of their commitment proceedings. What the proposal wants to do is to make more sex offenders eligible for this SVP commitment. And it does this by reducing from 2 to 1 the number of prior victims of sexually violent offenses that qualify an offender for this commitment to a mental hospital, and making additional prior offenses, such as certain crimes committed by a person while a juvenile, countable for the purposes of this commitment. So if you did something as a minor, as a juvenile, it could, even though under existing law, I believe, if you do a lot of stuff under as a minor, the offenses are closed and they have to hide them because they want you to be rehabilitated as an adult. This law would make that non-existing anymore, and you could be counted to make you report to a mental hospital for life. So this is kind of a major change in law. It says prison costs will also be affected because this is the legislative analysis. The measure would increase the prison population, resulting in a significant increase in prison population costs. In particular, increasing sentences for sex offenders would result in some sex offenders being sentenced to and remaining in prison for longer periods, resulting in a larger prison population over time. This would result in costs of unknown magnitude. GPS costs also, state parole and GPS monitoring costs would also increase, likely to be in the several tens of millions of dollars annually within a few years. These costs would grow to about $100 million annually after 10 years, with the costs continuing to increase significantly in the subsequent years. There's also the commitment costs, the SVP commitment costs to state mental hospitals. For instance, it costs the costs to operate these mental hospitals could reach $100 million annually within a decade, and then continue significantly thereafter. So there's these costs, because this commitment actually is to commitment for an undetermined period of time, but the cost to keep them there, of course, will be high. And they argue, the legislative analysts argues that the fiscal impact is quite high. So I think that there is this debate, of course, over this, but people see the legislation as protecting children when it's debatable whether any of this would protect children. So that's what's on the ballot tomorrow, Proposition 83, on the ballot in California. A controversial proposition that in the hysteria over sex crimes, the populace may rush to pass despite the high costs. In the official summary, it actually says, mentions that the costs would be several tens of millions of dollars initially, right? And so you wonder whether people don't care and will vote for it despite the cost, just because they think it's going to protect some little girl from being attacked in future. It's always easy, as in our discussion earlier with Chip Berlay, it's always easy to bring up the threat to children as a reason to vote for you. But practical solutions are never there. The speaker often appeals to your emotions to try to get you to vote their way. So watch out. Don't vote for anything just because you think emotionally about it. Use your brain and read the propositions before you go into the voting booth. Even the new you succumbed to this. The university paper editorially 2 weeks ago asked students to vote for this proposition. And last week there was a letter against that from, I believe, a student who could see the illogic of voting for it. And so just use your brains. Do not, I suggest not. I think it's always nice to use your brains rather than to vote emotionally. And I think that's what one should do in anything. So especially in something, if you are going to vote. Like Bob Avakian said on his clip, it's debatable whether voting will solve anything. You do want, people might want to remove the Bush regime, but what is it going to be replaced with unless people go out and speak out broadly and not just through the voting booth? That's my my little message for today, that people need to exercise their rights. But voting is not the only thing that one can do in this society. So let's we can close up with another another bit of lyrics here. But before we do that, I'll let you know that you can find audio of our shows online at kuci.org/tudng. And online will be on the webpage archived editions of earlier shows the last few years, MP3 audio as well as real audio from days past. And also some more information, links to different websites that will give you more information about the topics we have covered. In today's show, for instance, you can link to, there'll be a link there to the report that Chip Belay came out with on the religious right. That is on the website at www.publiceye.org. And his report was Running Against Sodom and Osama, the Christian Right Values Voters, and the Culture Wars in 2006, a report from the Political Research Associates. That's online in PDF and in HTML. And also there'll be a link to this Proposition 83 on sex offenders on the website for Subversity. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity.